Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this week's edition of Sibylline Insights, coming to you on yet another humid September afternoon from our London office. I'm your host, Leo Collins, Sibylline's Intelligence Delivery Lead, and I'm joined by two esteemed colleagues this afternoon, Associate Analysts Megan Sutcliffe and Tom Carter, representing our Middle East and Africa and Europe desks, respectively. Tom, Megan, welcome.
Thank you.
So, as we know, there is no such thing as a quiet week on this floor plate, and last week was no exception. But before we crack on to focus on what I know Tom is keen to explore, namely Chinese influence across Europe, let's spend the next few minutes capturing some of the other key headlines, starting in the US. So, Megan, on 12th of September, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy announced that he will task three committees with executing a formal impeachment into President Joe Biden, focusing on financial corruption. Is this going to impact Congress just a little bit?
So for sure, any time that the House spends time looking into charges like ones of financial corruption against a sitting president, this is inevitably going to delay other efforts to review and to pass legislation. Thus far, we've seen no evidence of wrongdoing by President Biden from any other inquiry, so I think it's pretty likely that this inquiry is going to run on for quite a bit of time while they search for evidence that potentially doesn't exist.
So we're sticking with our original assessment from the alert that we released last week that it's unlikely that the vote to impeach Biden will pass the Senate.
Absolutely. First of all, we think it's quite unlikely that it's even going to pass the House. McCarthy lacks the simple majority of 218 votes that would be needed to pass the articles of impeachment. In order to do this, McCarthy would need the support of centrist Republicans, most of whom have indicated that they're relatively reluctant to proceed with this inquiry. Even so, several moderates have indicated they would support an impeachment process, particularly if they think that the Biden administration is attempting to stonewall access to relevant documents, or if they see any concrete evidence linking him to financial corruption. So there is a realistic possibility that it will pass Congress. However, even if it did do that, if it got to the Senate, there a two-thirds supermajority would be needed to convict and remove President Biden. It's highly unlikely to happen as Democrats and independents control the Senate at the moment.
Sure, and reflecting what's now quite a common theme when it comes to assessing either end of the American political spectrum, minor protests, or maybe even more than minor protests, by right-wing and left-wing activists in Washington, D.C. and other U.S. urban centres, they remain a realistic possibility, right, in the short to medium term. Can we speak to the security impacts facing firms in this respect?
Absolutely. So any time there is a protest, there is a realistic possibility of those protests becoming violent, things like clashes with police or even clashes between protesters and counter-protesters. This would elevate collateral risks to staff and businesses in DC, and there's also the possibility of protesters blocking roads or erecting informal roadblocks, which would disrupt overland travel. That being said, though, in Washington, D.C., there is a considerable police presence. Local security measures are very well handled, and so they're likely to mitigate the risk of violence and damage to assets, particularly in key areas.
Awesome. And finally, we're sticking with our assessment that it's unlikely that President Biden's re-election campaign will be majorly damaged by an official impeachment inquiry.
100%. That is still our assessment. Polls indicate that support for and opposition to the inquiry is very polarised along party lines, so it's unlikely to fundamentally alter support among Biden's voting base. We're unlikely to see sort of these seismic shifts in voting patterns, particularly among Biden supporting Democrats, though there is a realistic possibility of independent and swing voters being influenced by the inquiry and any outcomes we may see, and this could alter voting patterns in key districts.
Thank you, Megan. Now, of course, Tom, the other big story to emerge last week almost borders on the comical, but for the fact that it's actually quite scary. So we were all treated to pictures and footage of the world's two biggest Bond villains, Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, shaking hands, smiling, apparently having a jolly old time in Russia. What was going on there, and more importantly, what is the so what and for whom?
So I think most importantly it reflects the Russian isolation on the international stage. But however, looking from a side point at the moment, we can understand that the meeting has a potential to mutually benefit both sides. Russia are desperately lacking Soviet-era ammunition, with even reports emerging on the front lines that they've been asked to conserve ammunition. North Korea doesn't have this in abundance, but it has supplies. And on the other side, we've got Russia has a possibility to offer North Korea military technology. An indication of what type of military technology could be the location of the meeting point, which was in a Russian spaceport. North Korea recently tried to launch two satellite missions, which have both failed. Space technology and infrastructure is becoming of increasingly strategic importance.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And just referencing something you mentioned there in terms of the impact this will have in Ukraine, I suppose the world now gets treated to either a ramped-up Russian artillery campaign in Ukraine, or perhaps of more concern for our colleagues and clients in the Asia-Pacific region, a ramped-up nuclear race, depending on what deals Kim and Putin have struck.
Absolutely. So we know for a fact that Putin and Kim Jong-un discussed defense cooperation mechanisms, and that can always include discussions of nuclear proliferation. We know that both North Korea and Russia are nuclear powers and maintain nuclear missiles. And while we may not have the exact details of what was discussed, and it would be wrong to speculate about a coming nuclear war, there is always the possibility that that was discussed and that that could have implications for regional and global security.
Excellent. And I suppose in this kind of axis of the excluded and geopolitics writ large, there's always a China factor to consider.
So we know that China is North Korea's most strategic ally in terms of the trade, but also diplomatic relations that they maintain. The increasing cooperation between North Korea and Russia is unlikely to change this situation. However, it does reflect a shifting strategic analysis of the region by all parties.
Excellent. And now, before we move on to the main topic of the Insights edition today, i.e. Chinese influence in Europe, I know that Megan wanted to touch briefly on some rather breaking news in the Sahel, namely Mali.
Yes, thank you, Leo. So over the past 2 weeks, we have seen a significant uptick in activity from the Coordination of Movements for Azawad, which is a Tuareg rebel network in northern Mali. On the 11th of September, the group announced that they consider themselves to be at war with the Malian state, essentially ending the 2015 Algiers Agreement, which settled the separatist conflict between the two. Since then, CMA militants have attacked at least two military bases in the Gao and Tombouctou regions, and it seems that there is an escalating offensive, particularly in these areas. We are concerned that this will result in an elevated risk profile for northern Mali, a deteriorating security environment, particularly considering the fact that Al-Qaeda and Islamic State militants are already active in northern Mali, have been conducting a blockade against the city of Timbuktu, and we're seeing the drawdown of UN peacekeepers throughout this year.
Just drawing on that final point, we know from 2012 that when the CMLA, is that the correct acronym? Yeah, they wanted to set up this independent state of Azawad, and jihadists essentially piggybacked the movement to try and spread their influence throughout all of Mali. Now, this was countered by a French-led operation, Serval and then Barkhane. France isn't exactly in Bamako's good books right now. So what can Bamako do in terms of its wider support base to prevent any potential scenario evolving?
So far we've seen two main avenues of action from the authorities in Bamako. The first is an increasing reliance on the Russian private military corporation, the Wagner Group. While we know that there are certainly changes that are going on with Wagner's structure and personnel, we're likely to see a continuation of the use of mercenaries in Mali in order to counter this threat. Secondly, what we've seen is increasing diplomatic efforts from the Malian military government to consolidate security within the region. Just 2 days ago, we saw reports that an alliance of Sahelian states had been struck between the military governments of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger that would probably allow them to increase their cross-border coordination in terms of countering transnational terrorist threat. That being said, though, all three of those governments suffer from widely understaffed and under-equipped militaries. They have been thus far unable to counter the spread of jihadism and, of course, the rise of Tuareg violence. And so whether or not this is actually going to stem the tide, it's quite unlikely.
And in a sentence, which firms, which companies, which entities are likely to be the most impacted by the situation?
So the firms that are most likely to be impacted by the rising violence and security environment deterioration are NGOs, so humanitarian organisations, particularly those operating in rural areas, and of course mining firms. Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso are well known for their natural resources, including gold and phosphates. So any business that is involved in mining high value resources and minerals will likely be targeted both in situ, in mining areas, but also while they are travelling overland.
Thank you, Megan. Okay, Tom, let's talk China in Europe. So, last week, there was a fairly huge headline-grabbing story and potentially really quite embarrassing story for His Majesty's government regarding an espionage threat stemming from a story about a political advisor who was arrested in March because of ties to Beijing. Can you talk more on this subject and what it means for wider government policy going forward?
Absolutely, thank you. So as you said, it's an awkward situation. It's the most notable espionage case between China and the UK for a number of years. So he's a parliamentary researcher who was arrested in March along with another individual. But the main antagonist in this situation is the parliamentary researcher. The reports came out on the Sunday Times. And they essentially highlighted that he had been working with a number of high-level conservative members and had these allegations have been put forward of espionage. This is not a new scenario for the UK Parliament, not necessarily even just the UK Parliament. There's been espionage scandals in both Canada and Australia. The MI5 had previously warned about potential Chinese espionage cases within the UK Parliament, one in 2021 and one in 2022. So as I said, this is not new. And I think which is bringing all this to light is in July, the Parliament's Security and Intelligence Committee, an independent function of Parliament responsible for the UK's intelligence community, posted its China strategy, highlighting that the government's measures are inadequate. We're dealing with Chinese security threats to the national infrastructure, specifically highlighting that China are using increasingly sophisticated espionage operations. And if you will bring in, this to light, we've been warned, essentially, and the government's response has been limited. At the moment, it's important to stress these are just investigations. Rishi Sunak was sat opposite the Chinese premier during a G20 summit in India, and he highlighted that possible interference with parliamentary democracy would be unacceptable. Obviously, he had to make a case. But at the moment, he's treading carefully. He said foreign policy will not be implicated by these investigations. However, I think importantly, should more concrete evidence go towards these suspects and find more incriminating evidence, there might be a shift within Sunak's position. Suella Braverman has already called on a tougher approach to China, which was not going to happen immediately. We've seen a more hawkish approach from Joe Biden's administration, which is potentially targeting components with dual use methods. So looking at AI, maybe quantum computing, for example. So a potential UK policy could follow a similar route to Joe Biden, but at the moment there's nothing too immediate which will come of it.
So speaking of a more hawkish approach to Chinese involvement in technology in Europe, I know that your desk has recently reported on the German government blocking an attempted acquisition of ClioConnect, a German satellite company, by a Chinese-owned Shanghai space technology company. What drove this decision, and what do you think the implications are for the broader satellite market in Germany?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's important to quickly add that the Shanghai-based company already had a 53% stake of the company, but wanted to acquire another 45% of a domestic German company. So this decision comes at an interesting point, especially for satellite infrastructure. The debate surrounding Elon Musk's decision to refuse Ukrainian access to his Starlink satellite network for a Ukrainian operation in Crimea has highlighted the strategic importance of space and satellite technology, which we previously mentioned, could have been an impact with Putin and North Korea's meeting. But essentially, it's indicative of Berlin's approach to China, which has been more cautious recently. There's ministers of government have highlighted that firms should attempt to de-risk from Chinese dependencies. And de-risking essentially is trying to avoid over-dependencies and reduce potential risks within their economy and general markets and infrastructure. So we saw earlier this year the announcements to potentially reduce the use of Chinese technology, so Huawei, within its 5G critical infrastructure. And this has been seen within within their policy at the moment. Government investment guarantees since August have only amounted to about 50 million euros, compared to the entirety of last year, which almost amounted up to 750 million euros. So there is a, it's a steadier approach. It's, de-risking is in its early stages, and it's not something which is going to be done immediately. It's going to take time. And this was seen in May. The government accepted a Chinese shipping company, Costco, a bid to hold part of Hamburg's terminal containers. So I think what we got to understand that while de-risking is going to become a major player next year, it's one of Europe's annual forecasts, which we'll come on later and definitely talk about a lot more in detail next year. But it's at its early stages, and it's important to stress there are business implications here. Technology companies with greater exposure to Chinese tech will face greater implications, possibly regulatory and policy risks.
Thanks, Tom. And I guess just sticking on this theme of de-risking, or as you so nicely put it, over-dependency, and the hawkish approaches accompanying these strategies, are there other technologies? E-cars, I think, are probably an area that we could look at as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Chinese e-cars specifically have been put into the spotlight recently. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's annual speech to the European Parliament confirmed that Brussels will be launching an anti-subsidy investigation into Chinese e-cars. So essentially a bit of context going into the Chinese e-cars. Ever since China banned the use of US cars, the Europe and Chinese automobile industry has boomed. A relationship was worth 24 billion euros in 2022. Now, the grievances come from France, which have been probing at Brussels for a while to launch an anti-dumping case. Chinese cars are flooding the markets and making it more competitive for used to be the big fish, European car manufacturers. However, the German industry, Europe's largest car producer, has been skeptical about this. Going back to the complications of de-risking, there are dependencies lies with other countries. And while the Eurozone is slightly sluggish on its with its economy, it's like, what sacrifice would these make at the detriment of having negative economic impacts? And the automobile industry is a core driver behind the German one. So what this means for Europe at the moment is that they will launch an investigation, which will take time. However, our assessment is that it's unlikely that Europe will take a more hawkish approach to this case, given the possible ramifications of a Chinese tit-for-tat trade war. Any sort of retaliatory measures which Chinese could pass could have a detrimental impact on European manufacturers. A large proportion of these, including both French Renault and German Mercedes, have plants in China. So the possible impacts could be really damaging.
Right, well, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Tom and Megan for your fascinating insights. And for everyone at home, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And we'll see you on the next one.